SDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Really? There are no nuns and priests and deacons at the soup kitchen?
Religious organizations have been on a winning streak at the Supreme Court.
Arguments in a case today suggested that run could continue.
From Monday, March 31st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, a brief history of the effort to expand presidential power.
And some lawmakers from both parties want new parents in Congress to be able to vote remotely.
If you want representation that truly reflects the American people, you want young working parents, why would you work against that?
Also, the story behind the new gold rush.
And why are people paying nearly $900 to see a Broadway show?
It's a scarcity factor. It's demand and supply, and there's a lot of demand.
Plus, is it last call for bars and clubs in Damascus?
Nightlife is shifting under Syria's new conservative leadership.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump's sweeping order that requires proof of citizenship to register to vote is facing its first legal challenge. NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports the federal lawsuit filed today argues the executive order is an unconstitutional overreach that threatens the voting rights of millions of Americans.
A coalition that promotes the voting rights of various groups, including Latino Americans, military families, and Arizona college students brought the lawsuit. It argues that voting rules are up to the states and Congress, not the president. Trump's executive order seeks to overhaul voting in this country, including by requiring proof of citizenship, like a U.S. passport, to register. Plaintiffs say that will prevent many from registering to vote. In the lead-up to the 2024 election, Trump and his allies pushed the baseless narrative that non-citizens would vote in large numbers. In fact, past audits have shown such cases are very rare. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
President Trump says the U.S. government is still looking for missing journalist Austin Tice. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump says they continue to run into dead ends.
Austin Tice is an award-winning freelance journalist and Marine veteran. He wrote for The Washington Post, McClatchy newspapers, and other U.S.-based outlets before he was captured in Syria in 2012. Speaking from the Oval Office, President Trump said there's been virtually no sign of him.
It's just a lot of dead ends. He's been gone for a long time. The problem is there's never been a sighting. You know, sometimes you'll have somebody, you're looking for him, and there's a sighting. There's never been a sighting of Austin.
In December, a rebel group ousted Syria's former dictator, leading to hopes that Tice would soon be found. Trump says they'll never stop looking until they find out something definitive. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
In France, far-right politician Marine Le Pen, who was a leading candidate to become president, has been barred from running for public office for 5 years after a French court today found her guilty of embezzling millions of dollars of EU funds. Le Pen was also sentenced to 4 years in prison with 2 years suspended. She says she will appeal. SpaceX is set to launch a privately funded human space flight from Florida's Kennedy Space Center tonight. From Central Florida Public Media, Brendan Byrne has more.
The mission will take the crew of four international participants to a polar orbit, a first for human spaceflight. After launching, the crew's Dragon capsule will head due south, putting them on an orbital path that will carry them over the poles of the planet. The crew will conduct 22 experiments from that orbit and will take the first X-ray from space. The mission is bankrolled by cryptocurrency entrepreneur Chun Wang, who was born in China but is a naturalized citizen of Malta.
Brendan Byrne reporting. You're listening to NPR News. In Myanmar, state media say the death toll from last week's powerful magnitude 7.7 earthquake has passed at least 2,000. Thousands more are injured. Rescue crews and family members have been going through the rubble of collapsed buildings and roads looking for survivors. And in many cases, they're digging by hand. The military government has allowed foreign aid to come into the country, and the State Department says USAID teams are on the way, despite President Trump's cuts to the agency. Rescue efforts are tough in the Southeast Asian country because of an ongoing civil war that's displaced millions of people, power outages, fuel shortages, and spotty communications. Parliamentarians from across Europe attended a memorial in Bucha, Ukraine today, marking the third anniversary of the town's liberation from the Russians. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports they came to show support and solidarity.
The Russians murdered more than 400 civilians in their month-long occupation of Bucha. A mass grave on the church grounds was exhumed after they were forced out. Archpriest Andriy Helivin shows a video. He says thanks to international media, Russian lies about it being faked were dispelled. He says it's important for the world to remember, especially the U.S. Because when there is talk about a ceasefire, for some reason they are silent about the crimes, he says. Justice is important. There can be no peace if crimes are ignored. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Bucha.
U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. Dow futures are down about 0.3%. NASDAQ futures are down about 0.5%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The U.S. Supreme Court appeared openly doubtful today about the state of Wisconsin's refusal to exempt Catholic charities from making payments into the state's mandatory unemployment system. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Today's case was brought by a single chapter of Catholic Charities in northern Wisconsin. The diocese claims that it should be able to opt out of the mandatory state unemployment compensation system and instead join an alternative church system, which is cheaper. The state, however, refused to grant Catholic Charities a religious exemption from paying into the state system. The state said that Catholic Charities functions the same way as other nonprofits, including Catholic hospitals, and is required to participate in the state unemployment tax system as it has done for decades. Catholic Charities counters that its mission is to carry out the gospel of the church to help people, and that it's thus entitled to an exemption from the mandatory state tax system. If it wins this case, the decision could, potentially at least, lead to a major exodus from the state system in Wisconsin and from similar state programs in 46 other states. And that, in turn, could destabilize the federal state unemployment compensation program that has existed for decades. This morning's argument started out with some hard questions for the charity. Here, for instance, is Justice Elena Kagan.
Are you saying that any group that comes in and says, we are a religious group doing religious activities for religious purposes, qualifies sort of no matter what, that there's no looking behind that at all?
Chief Justice Roberts pressed the point with this hypothetical.
What if you have a religion that thinks it's a sin to eat meat and they open a restaurant? Do they have a claim to be exempt from state taxes?
If the justices seem skeptical of the charity's opt-out position, both liberal and conservative justices seem downright hostile to the state's assertion that Catholic Charities, which serves and employs people of all faiths and doesn't allow proselytizing, is just like any other employer and thus is required to pay into the state's unemployment system. Wisconsin Assistant Solicitor General Colin Roth faced constant interruptions from the bench, but managed to say that the standard imposed by the state is that charities may be exempt from paying taxes if their activities involve worship or religious proselytizing or religious education. Catholic Charities fulfills none of those functions, he said. Justice Gorsuch interrupted at that point.
Really? There are no nuns and priests and deacons at the soup kitchen?
I'm not saying that at all, Your Honor.
The bishop, you know, is overseeing it? I mean, come on.
Justice Barrett wondered what would qualify as proselytizing.
Are they playing like hymns on the radio or like Christian rock at the evangelical soup kitchen? Is that proselytization or not because you're forced to sit there and listen to it?
Justice Alito had a similar question about what would qualify as proselytizing.
You don't get the soup unless you pray first.
And finally, Justice Kagan had this to say.
There are lots of hard questions in this area, but I thought it was pretty fundamental that we don't treat some religions better than other religions, and we certainly don't do it based on the content of the religious doctrine that those religions preach.
A decision in the case is expected by late June. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Two moms in the House of Representatives, one Republican and one Democrat, are trying to change House rules so new parents in Congress can vote remotely. GOP leaders are working to derail the effort. But Florida's Anna Paulina Luna, the Republican mom on the bill, is not backing down.
I think the argument here is that if you want representation that truly reflects the American people, you want young working parents, why would you work against that?
NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh reports.
Colorado Democrat Brittany Pedersen knew her vote against the GOP budget could be the deciding one. So she flew to Washington with her four-week-old son to cast it.
This is going to have a huge burden on our hospitals and unfortunately will have skyrocketing costs. I agree, Sam.
As a mom of a toddler, she knew Congress wasn't family friendly when she ran in 2022. But told NPR from her home office she worried about traveling with her newborn.
Scary, it's dangerous. You worry about your kid even going to the grocery store with you when they're that young, let alone, you know, being in an airplane, in an airport, being on the House floor.
She and Luna pressed the speaker to allow a vote to permit proxy voting for up to 12 weeks for parents around the birth of a child. House Speaker Mike Johnson refused.
I'm a father. I'm pro-family. The Republican Party is pro-family. We want to make it as easy as possible for young parents to be able to participate in the process. But proxy voting, in my view, is unconstitutional.
So Luna took the unusual step of working with Democrats to wield a procedural tool, getting a majority of members to sign a petition and force a vote.
The discharge petition is in place for the event that leadership is not doing the right thing. They're not doing the right thing right now. They're not being honest brokers. And that's the thing, is that that's the problem, is there's a trust issue in Washington. We're going to fix that. I'm not backing down.
She and Pedersen succeeded, and nearly a dozen Republicans bucked their leaders to sign the petition. But Luna says GOP leaders are playing hardball to block the effort, including dangling a plum committee seat for her to back down.
Let this be known. I am not for sale. My vote is not for sale. This is more than just a committee assignment.
Tennessee Republican Tim Burchett signed the petition, but says a senior Republican offered him votes on a pair of his bills to vote against Luna's.
Yeah, somebody said, well, if we got those bills on the floor, would you vote against Luna? And I was like, voting against pregnant women? Are y'all crazy?
GOP leaders are now planning to block the bill from coming up for a vote.
It blows my mind that they are this opposed to making sure that's Sam in the background.
Pedersen says this is about modernizing Congress, which she says is set up to favor older men.
It makes me angry. Because if they were in this position, they would have a different perspective.
In 2020, then Speaker Nancy Pelosi allowed proxy voting for all members due to the COVID pandemic, and it was used by members of both parties. Johnson signed on to a court filing opposing the practice in 2020, but cast his vote remotely more than once, including on this bill in 2022.
As a member designated by Mr. Mike Johnson of Louisiana, I informed the House that Mr. Johnson will vote no on H.R. 8404.
Republicans did away with proxy voting when they won the majority in 2023. The speaker says now he's fighting for the institution.
This is a deliberative body. You cannot deliberate with your colleagues if you're out somewhere else.
Luna says this would benefit Republicans who are already worried about their slim majority. A GOP colleague just announced she's expecting. And
what if I get pregnant? Is it going to be a problem that we're not here? I mean, my goodness, the oldest Congress in U.S. history. This will be better for the institution in the long term. And I think many of my colleagues agree with me.
A vote to decide on the rules change is expected as early as tomorrow. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
Well,
last week, the top grossing show on Broadway was not a musical. It was Good Night and Good Luck, the play written by and starring George Clooney. It brought in a whopping $3.3 million. And reporter Jeff London says this is not the only play headlined by Hollywood celebrities to find a box office bonanza.
For years, shows like Wicked, The Lion King, and Hamilton have led Broadway's box office. But lately, people have wanted to be in the room where it happens with George Clooney, as well as Denzel Washington and Jake Gyllenhaal and Kieran Culkin and Bob Odenkirk. They are all headlining Broadway plays with limited runs this spring, and their shows, Good Night and Good Luck, Othello, and Glengarry Glen Ross, are breaking box office records.
It's a scarcity factor. It's demand and supply, and there's a lot of demand.
Philip Boroff edits Broadway Journal, which reports on theatrical finances.
These are the shows that people want to see. And yes, the top stars do not want to commit for 6 months or a year. And that drives up the demand, and that drives up the prices. You know, of course, this is nothing new. I mean, back when Philip Seymour Hoffman was around doing Death of a Salesman a little over a decade ago, he was commanding almost $500 a ticket.
Now, if you want to see Othello with Denzel Washington and Jake Gyllenhaal in the same theater, the top ticket goes for $921. For Clooney's play about journalist Edward R. Murrow, it's $799.
There are a certain kind of people wired a certain kind of way who know there's a story behind the story, if you're bold enough to search for it.
The average ticket price for these shows hovers around $300. Boroff thinks that's a mixed bag for Broadway.
On one hand, it's always good for the industry to be in the news. Record grosses are generating stories. On the other hand, it also buttresses Broadway's image as being for the elite and being out of reach for people who aren't rich.
But to be fair, there are less expensive ways to see Good Night and Good Luck and Othello. Daily lotteries offer a very limited number of tickets for $49. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy npr.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. So far in his second term, President Trump has signed more than 100 executive orders. Critics say it's part of an unprecedented attempt to expand the power of the presidency. Recent presidents have also made widespread use of executive orders. Joe Biden signed 162 during his presidency. Barack Obama signed 277. But this kind of power has not always rested with the president. The hosts of NPR's history show Throughline, Rund Abdelfattah and Ramtin Arablouei, have the story of the first modern president to really expand executive power.
When the framers sat down to write the Constitution, they were divided over what the executive branch should look like. The one thing they definitely knew they didn't want was a monarchy, with a single person in charge holding all the power.
And that was in part a reaction to the existence of King George III. You know, the idea of executive tyranny is very high on people's minds at that point. Half the time, they're worried about making this office too strong. The other half, they're worried about making it too weak. It's kind of like Goldilocks, right? They want to make it just right.
This is Andy Rudalevich. He's a professor at Bowdoin College.
And have been researching and teaching about the executive branch for about 20 years now.
For 4 months, they debated whether or not there should be a president and what the terms and limits of executive power should be. And by mid-September 1787, they had made their minds up. The result was Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution.
The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States.
He's allowed to pardon people. He's allowed, of course, to appoint people to office.
By and with the advice and consent of the Senate.
He's allowed to make treaties.
By and with the advice and consent of the Senate.
But all of these, pretty much, except for the pardon power, have this big asterisk, right? Because they require that Congress act. It's pretty vague. It does lay out that sort of broad notion of the executive power, but it doesn't define the executive power.
Basically, Article 2 had left a lot of room for interpretation, whether intentionally or not, because all the president really needed in order to expand that vaguely defined power was buy-in from Congress.
When George Washington, the first president, took office, he often deferred to the Senate in his decision-making, and if they didn't agree with him, he rarely fought back. So the center of power didn't really rest with the president.
To get to what we think of as the modern presidency, in which the executive branch holds a lot more power, we have to fast forward through about 150 years, to the height of the Great Depression and the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
My friends, this is a day of national consecration.
We really see, as he takes office in 1933, the sort of shaping of the presidential office into something that we would recognize today.
In the working out of a great national program that seeks the primary good of the greater number, it is true that the toes of some people are being stepped on and are going to be stepped on.
So, what kind of things did FDR do to really, like, push the boundaries of the presidency?
Really, I think four things come together in terms of, you know, what the presidency looks like. One is this notion of unilateral authority, the ability to act using the administrative side, the executive side of government. He's the first president to have a legislative program in a comprehensive way, to propose things to Congress that he thinks they should adopt across the entire government. He's the first president to have a White House staff in the way that we would recognize it today. And then he's also the first president to really have the kind of visibility, the personification of the office.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Remember the fireside chats, the famous conversations that Roosevelt has? He's literally in your house talking to you.
My friend, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking.
In a way that previous presidents just couldn't do. And so that does give him, you know, sort of this soft power, which really does give him leverage to work on Congress, to be able to pass legislation that builds up the executive branch. And then once the executive branch is bigger, then he has more power to act through executive orders or other regulations that enables him to do more without going back to Congress.
Was anyone, like, worried about the things that Roosevelt was doing? I guess at the time people would be like, this is a lot coming from the president.
Oh, yeah. You know, Roosevelt early on, right, starts talking about, well, I need Congress to give me, you know, emergency powers to fight this depression. And by the way, he said at one point, if you don't give them to me, I'm going to use them anyway. And so that certainly got people to sit up. Now, Congress, in fact, did give him the powers he was asking for in that case. But, you know, there's a lot of nervousness when he ran for an unprecedented third term in 1940.
This was before the 22nd Amendment was ratified, which limits the U.S. president to two terms. So Roosevelt won that third term, the only president who ever did.
And then the U.S. entered World War II.
Suddenly, again, you have a lot of authority delegated to the president, not only to run the war, but to effectively run the national economy.
The state of wartime emergency allowed Roosevelt to institute rationing, rent control, wage and price controls.
The crisis really does precipitate changes in, you know, the way the U.S. government is perceived by the public, what's expected of it. And Roosevelt is ready to jump into that. He becomes, again, sort of the prototype of what people will expect a president to be from then on.
And then Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066. It authorized the forced relocation and incarceration of Japanese Americans.
You know, ripping people from their homes and putting them in camps. I think even at the time, there were many people who thought it was tyrannical.
The legality of FDR's Executive Order 9066 was questioned by the courts, and the case made its way all the way up to the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court upheld it as, you know, basically, again, a military necessity, and they were going to defer to the president and to the military in this case. There's a famous dissent to that case, though, which gets to the broader point of presidential emergency powers. And Justice Jackson says at that time that, you know, these emergency powers are like a loaded weapon, kind of lies around waiting for somebody to pick it up and use it for something else. And that, I think, is something we have seen over time, that presidents will act in one way, and then future presidents will look back and say, well, he did it, and I should be able to do it. I can use that precedent to bolster my own case for enhanced power.
That was Andy Rudalevich speaking with Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdelfatah, hosts and producers of NPR's Throughline. You can hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts.
This is NPR News. Traveling to the U.S. from abroad has gotten riskier. In recent weeks, visa holders and even lawful permanent residents have been detained trying to enter the country. International tourists have been affected too.
There isn't a lot of explanation. There isn't a lot of consistency on what they're doing.
Hear their stories tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Sign of the Times, a new Hyundai plant in Georgia that was supposed to produce only electric vehicles has changed course.
Originally, everybody thought, okay, the world is going to be fully electric. But soon we realized the pace of electrification was not going to be as fast as everybody thought.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. In Wisconsin, both Supreme Court candidates were out campaigning ahead of Tuesday's election. The results will determine if the court's majority flips from liberal to conservative. From member station WWM, Chuck Quirnbach reports.
Circuit Court Judge Brad Schimmel has been endorsed by President Trump, and groups backed by business executive Elon Musk have poured in $20 million of support. The Republicans say the state Supreme Court contest could affect House redistricting in Wisconsin for 2026 and the Trump agenda. Schimmel says he and his supporters are energized.
I've never seen voters this revved up about a court race before.
Schimmel's opponent, Circuit Court Judge Susan Crawford, has backing from some prominent Democrats. She's promising to fight to the finish.
Fight for every vote we can get in Wisconsin, and I believe we can win this election on Tuesday.
Crawford says she's not made any promises on House redistricting. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quirnbach in Milwaukee.
In Washington, staff at the Institute of Museum and Library Services have been placed on leave. The agency provides grant funding to libraries and museums across the country. NPR's Andrew Limbong has the story.
The grants provided by the IMLS have supported employee training, new pilot programs, and basic services like computers and internet in rural libraries. Steve Potash is the CEO of Overdrive, which distributes digital products such as ebooks and audiobooks to libraries. He says small libraries will be most affected by funding cuts, but that impacts can spread.
When a public library, which has growing demand for their online and digital materials, is now getting any kind of budget cuts, hard decisions have to be made.
According to the agency, the IMLS awarded more than $250 million in grants and research last year.
This is NPR. A new blood test may help show whether a person has cognitive problems related to Alzheimer's. NPR's John Hamilton has more on the research.
Existing blood tests can reveal the sticky amyloid plaques associated with Alzheimer's, but they don't indicate problems with thinking and memory. Dr. Randall Bateman of Washington University in St. Louis says the new test is different.
It was much more related to memory loss, symptom onset, dementia stage, all the things that patients care about.
The experimental test measures part of a protein called tau that forms tangles inside neurons. A study found that levels of this protein rise when the symptoms of Alzheimer's begin to appear. Bateman says eventually doctors should be able to use the test to help diagnose Alzheimer's and select patients who will benefit from drug treatment. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The humanitarian crisis in Myanmar has worsened after last week's massive earthquake. State media reported at least 2,000 deaths after the magnitude 7.7 quake knocked out power, causing fuel shortages. Authorities say 50 preschool children have died. This after their classroom collapsed. 200 Buddhist monks were crushed by debris from their fallen monastery. Relief efforts are being hampered by spotty communications and shortage of fuel, as well as an ongoing civil war in Myanmar. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station
And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A few years ago, Hyundai Motor Group triumphantly announced it would be opening a new electric vehicle plant near Savannah, Georgia. Here's Hyundai executive Jose Munoz in 2022.
We heard the clarion call of this administration to hasten the adoption of new electric vehicles and reduce carbon emissions.
Well, that was during the Biden administration when NPR's Camilla Domonoske went to the grand opening of this new plant last week. She was struck by a change in tone on EVs.
Hyundai's new Meta plant is a huge complex of buildings surrounded by timberlands and swamp west of Savannah. Inside, the production line has a clean chemical aroma, what can only be described as new car factory smell. On stage at the ceremony, Munoz, who's now Hyundai's global CEO, called it a campus for the future of mobility. And it is futuristic. Robots are everywhere, stamping and welding metal, autonomously carting parts around, while humans assemble vehicles together piece by piece. In his speech, Georgia Congressman Buddy Carter emphasized the thousands of jobs this plant is creating.
We have the single largest economic development project in the history of our state, right here.
But there was one theme conspicuously missing from the parade of speeches. Despite all the electric vehicles surrounding the stage, the word electric was not mentioned once, nor batteries or EVs or clean or green or carbon or climate. And that's a big change. In 2022, this project was announced as a dedicated EV facility making exclusively electric vehicles. The speeches then made a big deal about EVs. Munoz, the CEO, acknowledged things had changed when he spoke with reporters after the grand opening.
When we started this project, originally everybody thought, okay, the world is going to be fully electric. We were also thinking that way, but soon we realized that the pace of electrification was not going to be as fast as everybody thought.
Over the past couple years, EV sales growth slowed while hybrids were taking off.
So then very quickly we decided we're going to produce also hybrid vehicles here.
Hyundai is actually changing this plant from producing only electric vehicles to being flexible about what they make. They're adding even more production, most of it hybrids, Munoz says. And it's not just this one plant. Companies like Ford, GM, and Volvo have all slowed some EV plans and focused more on hybrids. It's hard to ignore that this is happening as the government is pulling a U-turn on EVs. Under President Trump, regulations that would push automakers to make EVs are being rewritten. Tax breaks to help consumers buy them are at risk, and funds for building EV chargers are frozen. Hyundai execs are adamant that they don't rely on government incentives when they decide to build plants like this.
Building plants on the assumption on incentives is not a good decision, because then something like this might happen, and then what am I going to say? Hey, we invested $12.6 billion, so I made a mistake. I'm sorry. No, you need to have very solid plants.
But of course, government policy can influence consumer demand. Tax rebates and abundant chargers can change what people buy. Similarly, the expansion here is not a response to tariffs. These plans were in place long before Trump announced a new 25% tariff on imported cars last week. But it's good timing, or as Kia COO Steve Center put it,
it's convenient in that sense.
Kia is part of Hyundai Motor Group and will also build vehicles here. Center 2 emphasized that the market drives their EV plans.
We'll sell them where people want them. You can't force markets.
The auto industry isn't giving up on EVs. They're quiet, sporty, cheap to maintain, and automakers don't want to cede the global market to China. But automakers are pulling back, talking about their EV plans in more measured tones, or when they're on stage at a grand opening, not talking about them at all. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
And Emily Jones with member station WABE contributed to that report.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
The bodies of three missing U.S. Army soldiers have been recovered after their vehicle was pulled from a muddy swamp in Lithuania. The sunken vehicle was first discovered last week, and the search continues for a fourth missing soldier. For more, we are joined by NPR's Juliana Kim. Hi there.
Hi there.
So these four American soldiers went missing in Lithuania 6 days ago. Who were they and what were they doing there?
So they were all from Fort Stewart near Savannah, Georgia. The U.S. Army said the soldiers were deployed to Lithuania as part of Operation Atlantic Resolve, the purpose being to help combat forces in Europe and show America's support for NATO. They went missing last Tuesday while on a training mission near the border with Belarus. They were sent out to help repair and tow another military vehicle. And then the next day, the soldiers' own large armored vehicle was found submerged in a swamp. I also want to note the Army hasn't released the names of any of the soldiers yet, in part because the Army is still in the process of notifying next of kin, and also because the fourth soldier remains missing.
What have the recovery efforts been like?
It's been a massive undertaking. Part of the challenge is that the swamp is so dense. U.S. military officials have described the mud there as clay-like. Also, the vehicle itself is incredibly heavy, weighing more than 130,000 pounds. And over the past week, it's just been sinking deeper and deeper. To put it into perspective, right before it was pulled out, the Army said the vehicle was about 13 feet below the water surface and stuck in more than 6 feet of mud.
So how do you extract a vehicle of that size from a swamp that thick?
You know, for days, rescue crews have been using all sorts of draining, digging, and dredging techniques to remove the water and mud from that site, but that progress was slow. Then a U.S. Navy dive team arrived. At first, they also faced difficulties navigating that thick mud, which was also impossible to see through. But on Sunday, the Army said the divers managed to attach cables to hoist points on the submerged vehicle, and that helped finally pull it out of the swamp. I also want to note that this has been a multi-country effort. More than 200 people were involved, and that includes both American and Lithuanian soldiers, and also a group of engineers from the Polish Armed Forces.
And what is happening in the search for the fourth soldier?
Search efforts are continuing. More military and rescue personnel are expected to come help. In the meantime, Colonel James Armstrong, who's the commander for the 1st Armored Brigade, said he's ensuring that the families and colleagues of the soldiers are being supported during this grieving process. And he called his unit an incredibly tight-knit family.
That is NPR's Juliana Kim. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Myanmar's military authorities say the death toll from Friday's 7.7 magnitude quake in the center of the country has risen to more than 2,000 people. Thousands more have been injured, and it's virtually impossible to know how many remain trapped under debris. Time is running out before the focus of the relief effort shifts from rescue to recovery. Michael Sullivan reports from neighboring Thailand.
A little more than 72 hours after the quake struck, Myanmar's state-run television interrupted programming to deliver a somber announcement. The anchor announced a seven-day-long national state of mourning, a tacit acknowledgement, perhaps, that the window for finding survivors under the rubble is closing. At 1:20 Friday afternoon, the earthquake struck Myanmar's second-largest city, Mandalay, with such force that the minaret of this mosque crumbled into dust, taking the mosque with it, as onlookers fled in terror. Multi-story buildings fell all over the city as well. Others remained standing but tilting drunkenly as aftershocks threatened to bring them down too. Here's a retired teacher in Mandalay who doesn't want to be identified out of fear of retaliation from the military. My house was badly damaged, she says, so now we're sleeping out here in the road. A hot pot shop near my house just disappeared into the earth, she says. We cannot count how many have died. Maybe not, but with temperatures hovering around 100 degrees, sometimes more, one rescue worker who requested anonymity for the same reasons says you can smell them. The crematoriums cannot burn all the bodies recovered, he says. Many have still not been retrieved, and the smell coming from the rubble is so strong, he says, rescue workers are having a very hard time in even becoming sick. That's in Mandalay, the city closest to the epicenter. But roughly 150 miles to the south, in the new capital, Naypyidaw, opened in 2006 on the advice of an astrologer who declared it an auspicious place, a rescue worker who also insisted on anonymity out of fear of reprisal from the junta disagrees. Now he says there's no power, no running water, and no internet in Naypyidaw, and hundreds of buildings have just disappeared into the earth. 80% of the city, he reckons, is destroyed, including a multi-story government hospital whose collapse has been confirmed by state-run media. And all this in areas rescue workers have access to. There are many more they haven't been able to reach, including many in contested areas where phone and internet access are cut off, either by the military or by the quake. Meanwhile, calls for a ceasefire in the civil war, now in its fourth year, to allow humanitarian assistance to those who need it, have been ignored by the military. On Friday, just hours after the quake, it conducted airstrikes against opposition targets in Karen State. And just yesterday, more airstrikes were reported in neighboring Shan State. The military determined to cling to power, it seems, no matter what the cost. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Tariffs continue to roil stock markets. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ today ended their worst quarters in almost 3 years. Another kind of investment is booming, though, the price of gold. It hit an all-time high today, and analysts expect it to keep on soaring. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen is here to help us understand why. Hey there.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Hi. So gold at an all-time high today. What's the latest?
Well, the price of gold has been rising for a couple of years now, but it's really hit a hot streak since the beginning of this year. A single ounce of gold now costs more than $3,100. That's a record high, and some analysts are predicting that it's going to keep going up. There are a few reasons behind this, but the primary reason is what's going on elsewhere in the financial markets and the economy.
And just explain that. Explain the link.
Well, President Trump's tariffs, they're causing huge uncertainty, as you know, among investors and businesses. They're also sparking widespread fears about higher prices for consumers and the increasing potential for a recession. And that's making people want to buy into something that's seen as a safe haven, like gold. I called up Bank of America's Michael Widmer, who put out a very bullish report on gold last week. He gave a lot of credit to the ongoing tariffs drama.
It's those tensions, the uncertainty about economic policies or the policy uncertainty that has really been supportive for the gold market.
So he's betting that as long as that uncertainty continues, the price of gold will continue to go up.
And how certain are we about that? Is gold a safer investment?
Well, Widmer also points out that gold can definitely be volatile. It's been on a rally recently, but what goes up can always go back down. That said, gold does have this reputation for what's known as the fear trade. It's tangible. It has value in and of itself. And so in times of crisis, gold is often perceived as safer than stocks. I talked about this with Lee Baker, who runs Claris Financial Advisors in Atlanta.
When it seems like the world is going to hell in a handbasket, gold usually appreciates.
That said, he warned that there can be downsides to buying and owning gold, even in times of crisis.
Okay, so before we all go out and buy a little lump gold and put it under our mattress, what is the case against doing that?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I asked Baker. Should I go out and buy gold? And he told me to slow my roll.
If you're buying gold right now, just because you're caught up in the buzz because it's going up, I'd probably say leave it alone because it's likely to lead to some form of disappointment.
He pointed out that unlike stocks or bonds, gold doesn't pay any dividends or interest, and it can be complicated to own. There are ways to invest in gold-related funds without actually going out and buying physical gold. But if you do want to hoard some gold bars, you have to think about things like insurance and home security. And again, there's just no guarantee that any one investment is always going to go up. So there's no silver bullet, or in this case, gold bullet, that can protect you from everything that's happening in the economy and the wider world.
Platinum bullet. I am holding out for the platinum bullet. NPR's Maria Aspen, thank you.
Thank you.
When conservative Muslim rebels in Syria swept into Damascus last year, they took control of a city with thriving nightlife, including lots of bars. They have not imposed strict Islamic law, at least not yet, but the fighters who were once associated with Al-Qaeda did try to issue last call for those bars. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from Damascus on what happened next.
When Syrian President Bashar al-Assad fled, Kifah Zaini threw a party at the bar he runs called Sugar Man.
First day I opened after Assad fall. It was carnival.
It was like a carnival, he says. But he did have a niggling fear, though. Syria's new rulers had banned alcohol in Idlib, northwest Syria, where they first governed. And Zaini, well, he makes a living serving alcohol. 10 days later, that fear was confirmed when two bearded guys with guns knocked on his door.
Two men with guns, front of the door. I go outside and I say, come on, what's happened? Nothing. You have permission? And I said, no, I have no permission.
Zaini does not have an alcohol license. To get one, you have to be located more than 100 yards from a school or religious site, which rules out practically every location in Damascus. And Syria hasn't issued alcohol licenses for Zaini's area anyway since 1960, he says. Under Assad, most bars were technically illegal. Owners would pay a $2 fee, and authorities left them alone. Zaini feared it might not be as easy going forward. So on a lark, he invited the bearded guys into his bar, if they would put down their guns.
And I have video. They danced here. And it's so very strange, because it's just like performance art. It's just like Bin Laden danced with us. In that time, you feel, okay, we can connect with these people. They are Syrian.
In the new Syria, there are some strange bedfellows. A secular tattooed alcohol wholesaler named Aboudi told me he buys liquor in bulk from Islamist fighters in the mountains, where they've got a warehouse, he says, full of confiscated stuff.
We pay $2,000 for 1 hour's opening. We took whatever you can.
And they open 100 what?
100 bucks,
warehouse?
200 bucks, 500 bucks. You have 1 hour.
To take as much alcohol as you can grab. He didn't want to give his surname because all of that is also illegal. If this sounds like the Wild West, Syria's new government has moved to crack down. In a single day, it recently shut 60 bars in Damascus.
And they didn't give us any reason or any warning before. They just sent two guys. They put this red wax.
Naveen Mahmoud says they sealed shut the doors of her bar, called Cosette, with red wax, a method that goes back to antiquity. She, too, does not have an alcohol license, in part because she wasn't alive 65 years ago when they issued them last. Mahmoud says she knows Syria's new leaders are conservative, and she tried to meet them halfway. She voluntarily closed during Ramadan fasting hours. She put curtains on the windows.
Respecting the holy month, you know?
So when they shut her down, she says it felt like betrayal of the coexistence that's made Damascus nightlife famous, even in wartime, perhaps more so then.
People here, they respect each other. They respect each other's religions, traditions.
Mahmoud and other bar owners appealed to the mayor. They deluged social media. And in less than a day, all 60 closures were lifted. NPR asked two government departments about this. A spokesperson for one didn't know a thing about it. The other confirmed the reversal, but said they didn't want to talk. Mahmoud believes this may be a lesson for them, though.
What worked in Idlib, it won't work in Damascus. See? It's different.
That night, 60 bars across Damascus reopened with gusto.
What would you like to drink? We are celebrating now, so.
But it's unclear how long this party will last. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Damascus.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation, collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today, so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever.
And now the Bill Evans Trio at the top.
Good evening. We have with us tonight, very fortunately, Chuck Israel on bass. We're going to do a